This is Sarah Reith with Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. Today we'll hear from George Montag, who was born in Hungary and came to the United States when he was 7 years old. He came to the Bay Area from New York for the Summer of Love, then settled in Elk in 1971. We spoke last summer in a little room in the Greenwood School with the smell of eucalyptus trees and the ocean wafting past the door. I was late because a cloud of butterflies had risen up out of the forest along the Greenwood Philo Road.
I was so young. I was a single father already. My wife and I had split up. When I came to Elk, it was just my son who was two and myself. And we schlepped up here. And I just wanted to be in the country. I wanted to grow things. I grew up in New York City. And while it's wonderful in New York City, I couldn't live there anymore. And I just wanted to, live a peaceful, old-fashioned kind of lifestyle. Back to the land wasn't like a defined thing back then, If it had been, that's what I would have wanted to do. But we didn't know. I didn't really realize that's what we were doing. But that's what we were doing. It just seemed friendly. And Elk especially was a very laissez-faire town. The old-timers did not have any antagonism towards the newcomers as long as you didn't try to push your ideas on them too hard. And they didn't try to push their ideas on you. And it was a live and let live situation. There were just not that many old-timers left, and maybe they were just mellower than the average run of old-timers, but everybody seemed to get along just really nicely. And so it just seemed ideal. I planted my first garden because I'd lived in cities all my life and had a little side yard, planted a garden. Something I'd always wanted to do, and so I got to do it. And I just said, I'm just going to stay here and have this kind of nice outdoor country life. First, I was in town, and there was, the newcomers had started a little Sunday soccer game that we played in this rock-strewn field in the middle of town. And some of the older, the young old-timers that were more our age were playing soccer with us, so we got to meet everybody. And they seemed like a friendly sort, They maybe drank more than the newcomers, I guess everybody was like smoking pot, so we had that in common. Man that owned the garage, Mel, kind of shepherded you along into helping you with your plumbing or whatever else you needed help with that you obviously, coming from the city, knew nothing about. The first year I was here, there was a big freeze and all the pipes froze, and so we needed help. Everybody needed a lot of help. And you got your car fixed at the garage, and you get some free advice. And his brother owned the store, so the two brothers owned the two big thriving enterprises in town, the store and the garage. And we just got along well with all these people right from the beginning. And then I met these guy that found our land, had come back from being in the merchant marine in Vietnam. And he had retired out of that, and he looking for a piece of land. Went down our driveway. I live about 2.5 miles up Greenwood Road. And it was May. The rhododendrons were in bloom. For sale, he bought the property. And then he said, I need more people to live here and help me make some of the payments. And that's how we ended up there. And in the beginning, we just did our thing. He did his thing, and then there was another couple that were also living there. So it was three couples. And we got along well, at least at the beginning. Though those situations, in my experience and almost everybody else's, those situations tend to deteriorate over time, as ours did. Friends come and go sometimes in life. Sometimes they're friends for life and sometimes they're not. I had high hopes. I was going to do everything by hand. We didn't have electricity or anything. We didn't have a drivable driveway in the winter. It's 3/4 of a mile down to where my house is off the road. And we were like wheelbarrowing laundry up the driveway to where we could park a car. And I was living in that trailer and building house by hand. And I had this crazy idea that I wanted to build this hexagonal house. And I wanted to do this fancy notching and all this kind of stuff. And And I probably wouldn't have listened to anybody who tried to talk me out of it anyway, because we just were doing what we were doing as best we could. And I was, you know, a lot of hand sawing. I didn't have any power tools or anything. And spent a couple of years building this thing while living in the trailer. And then by that time, I was not ready to move in, but felt like we needed to move in. We had a child, Donna and I, who I met in Elk. Okay, so maybe I should get back there. I met my wife in Elk. She came here with Cat Mother, which was this rock group that moved to Elk. She knew them, and she ended up in Elk and took over this little nursery school. And meanwhile, I had gotten a job figuring out that the way to get work here was the only people that seemed to have money were people that could afford to go to the bar. So I'd go to the bar in the afternoon and meet these loggers who were coming off work and getting a drink. And eventually one of them gave me a job. So then my wife was running the nursery school, or my present wife, and so she met my kid before she met me, because once I had a job, I needed childcare.
What was the job that you're doing?
I was a choker setter. A choker setter puts the cable around the log and then hooks it up to a hook on a bulldozer, and they haul it out of there. Really hard work. At the then relatively decent wage of $3 an hour. That was more than we were living on, was a $3 an hour job. It was amazing. We could save some money out of that. And then eventually I got a job with a really good logger and I was making $5 an hour and working 60 hours a week, and he paid overtime because he was an honorable guy. And so I was really saving money then and living on unemployment for, you know, whenever, the entire rainy season. Did that for 3 years, decided I had enough money to start building a house and started scrounging and buying materials and went from there.
Can you describe the house that you eventually built?
Okay, so it's a hexagonal house. It's about 16 feet on a side. It's 2 stories tall. It's sort of my own variation on timber framing. It's post and beam construction. I notched the posts into the beams with these dovetail joints, and I was trying to do it all without nails, or at least the framing. I was drilling holes and pinning it with a 3/4-inch dowels and through the framing, and it was a much slower process than I thought. In fact, I thought I was going to find logs around the property and mill all the lumber myself with an Alaskan mill. I spent the whole summer milling 8x8s, which got me enough 8x8s to get from the foundation up to the first floor level. So then it was, okay, time to like get some work and save money and buy lumber, because that wasn't going to work. But so it's, you know, and I designed the walls around the windows that I was able to buy, you know, used windows that I bought cheaply. And the whole idea of a hexagon was, bees, hives are hexagonal. They're really stable. That's a great thing. We'll just build a hexagonal house and we'll do all this framing with these dovetails, because that's going to look really cool. And again, nobody talked me out of it, and I probably wouldn't have listened anyway.
Talk about your gardening and how you figured out, or how you created food for yourself.
Started reading organic gardening magazine, tried to follow the tenets of organic gardening. And we talked to people, we read stuff, and then you grew, you know, the stuff that either you wanted to grow or the stuff that you were told did well around here. So it would be, you know, you wanted to grow corn because fresh corn is really good, tomatoes, peppers. And you grew all the stuff that, and some of it worked, some of it didn't. The stuff that worked, you grew more of. Stuff didn't work, you kept trying anyway until you came to your senses. Eventually, you know, those of us that kept at it, like I've continuously had a garden, and looks really great out there right now. I'm still doing it, and I'm still enjoying being in my garden for hours every day. So I guess I got what I wanted out of life on that. And along the way, I tried a little semi-commercial market gardening, which was fun and a lot of work and made very little money. I found out that farming is different than gardening.
Did you ever have any memorable encounters with wildlife when you're out here?
Well, I mean, you see the occasional bear and it'll come and crush your garden fence trying to come in there for reasons unknown. In my case, it was to get at the bone meal that was in a garbage can for fertilizer. The bear smelled it, thought it was something good to eat. And you come out and, you know, your corn would be all gone. And you'd come out at night and there was the raccoons just tearing the ears of corn off the plant just before they were ripe enough for you to pick. And you eventually learn that, okay, they're going to get some of it, but I'll get most of it, and that's okay. I wasn't big on killing things if I didn't have to kill anything.
So do you have any memories of special gatherings or get-togethers or any kind of annual events that happened in the community?
As you may or may not know, we have the annual Great Day in Elk Festival, which you know, of course, it's always a great day in Elk. That's the kind of joke of it. And so that started about 45 years ago, and I've been to every one from the very beginning. And it was originally going to be this fun day, and the kids would have these games, and we'd raise some money to help build the community center. And now it's the only fundraiser that the community center actually needs to hold. We raise all the money to keep that thing running in one day every year. So I volunteered at one thing or another every year for all those years. I ran the greased pole, $100 bill at the top of a greased pole, that an attractive nuisance to keep people interested in being there. And that's something that everybody in the community comes together and centers that part of their summer around. And you know, you're home working on your own homestead all the time. This is a chance to get together with everybody in the community and have a nice time with them. And it was so popular that we've continued it every year. And, you know, not a year has been missed. Though we have occasionally talked about, well, if all the people have to work on this, just threw in $100 a piece, we wouldn't have to do any work. It'd probably raise just as much money, but that wouldn't be fun. So we've decided to keep it all fun.
You just mentioned that everybody is always at work homesteading. What's the toughest thing about homesteading?
Cut and split hundreds of cords of firewood. Firewood is, though, you know, very satisfying, but hard work. Keeping your garden going. Going in the early days, we'd go down to the dairy and slop out the calf barn to get the fertilizer, you know, so-called free fertilizer, though it would seem like, it was, looking back on it, very hard work for the free fertilizer. I remember in the early days, because the soil was so poor where we lived, that I had to like constantly be trying to make more compost to try to enrich the soil and constantly searching for stuff to bring home. And then you plant fruit trees, so you have to keep the fruit trees pruned, and you have to keep you have to pick all the stuff. And then when you pick all the stuff, you have to deal with all the stuff. So it seemed like there was a never-ending supply of chores that needed to be done for all of us. And yet we still had time to go to the river a couple of times a week during the summer and, you know, still have fun activities. There might have been more hours in a day back then than there are today. That's the only explanation. It was a very do-it-yourself kind of thing. We made our own community, which was many of us coming from cities and other places that didn't seem to have much community, even though there were many, many people. That was something that I think we were all hungry for, a feeling of community, and we were able to create our own community, including the community center, but in general, the community of Elk, there's the coastal community, I remember the Jewish community. We had to create that out of nothing also. Because we were looking for something, some kind of spiritual path so we could pass it on to our kids. Or at least that was my motivation. I wasn't particularly religious when I was brought up. But I wanted to have my kids to be able to have a Jewish experience or some kind of spiritual experience. And that was the one that I was at home with. I didn't want to do the Native American thing or like the Buddhist thing because I knew nothing about that.
Can you talk a little bit about what it took to create a Jewish community out here?
Originally, it was for Jewish people, the High Holy Days, you know, the most important things on the calendar, the High Holy Days, which come in the fall, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And that was something that even if you were barely religious or not religious at all, or even an, you know, atheist or agnostic Jew, you still wanted to do the High Holy Days. And the other thing was Passover, the Passover Seder, which I really don't know anybody that doesn't remember that fondly. Whatever form it took in your family, it's something you remember very fondly. So we wanted to have that. And that just led to, well, we're doing this, and then we had to rent buildings and you know, find somebody that could officiate and find a rabbi. And it just kind of organically grew until we actually incorporated as a community. And that thing's quite ongoing. All, you know, we bought an old church that's our shul in Casper. That's now, I think we've had it about 20 years now. Before that, we were at the mercy of whatever we could rent from either other organizations or, you know, in one case, the top floor of a house in Mendocino.
So what was the first holiday that you celebrated as the Jewish community?
Probably the very first one I remember is there was a community Seder for Passover, which wasn't particularly Jewish, but it was very community. Passover is a holiday where you don't eat any leavened products or products that could be leavened. But it was a potluck, so people bought like muffins. You know, they didn't quite get the concept because they, you know, it was open to anybody who wanted to come, and so it was. But it was still it was definitely a feeling of community that brought people together, and then the people that felt like they had more knowledge or they wanted something a little more traditional just got together and talked about it, and we just kind of made it happen. And then the next year, we started trying to get people to come up here to officiate for High Holy Days. You can do a Seder as just a family thing, but for High Holy Days, you really feel like you need a rabbi or somebody who's at least knowledgeable enough to pass for a rabbi. We actually hired a rabbi. We got, you know, a big enough community with enough members to actually get a full-time rabbi eventually. So like the first experiences with our own rabbi, and then eventually in our own building is probably the most memorable part of it. And there's an ongoing Saturday morning service that's kind of like an important thing. We also have our own Chevra Kedisha, which is a burial society, because we were told by a wise scholar one time that's one of the first things you have to set up is a burial society so people can have a proper Jewish burial. So we did that. Doing my first tahara, which is like this ritual washing the body, that was kind of a big thing for me. And it's an awesome kind of thing. You know, you're kind of in touch. Death is just as important as birth in many ways. So it gets you in touch with the ineffability of life.
You said that your wife helped found the nursery school. Is that the school that we're sitting in right now?
No, this is there's been many reincarnations of nursery schools and preschool around here. No, it was just in a little tiny house down in town, which is now part of one of the cabins for a bed and breakfast. And this one woman had started it that moved here with the band originally. And then she had to leave because she was British, and she had to go either go back to England, get her visa renewed, or marry an American. I forget what she ended up doing. But she left, and my wife and this other woman took over the nursery school and the house that it was in as a place to live. And so I had just gotten this job and working in the woods, and my son needed daycare. I think I had a girlfriend at that point. She was not interested in caring for my child, and she was not interested in hanging around very long. I think she had left by then. So I met the nursery school teacher and got along. And the rest, as they say, is history.
So what about the rest of educating your kids? Did you do any kind of alternative homeschooling or public school? How did that go for you?
We are sitting where my kids went to school. My son went here from kindergarten through sixth grade in basically a one-room school. You know, we were hands-on parents, but I personally didn't want to do homeschooling. Some people did. Some people were really wild about homeschooling. when you live in the woods and your kid hardly ever sees any people unless you make a point of getting them to somebody else's house or having somebody come down to your house, you want to have that socializing, the socialization and interaction with other kids. So school was like a great thing. The kids loved going to school.
Were you able to teach your kids any of the homesteading skills that you picked up?
You can teach them if they want to learn. I got a lot of work out of my son when he was little. I had him stacking firewood and, you know, weeding the garden and doing all that stuff. But didn't seem like that was his real life interest, you know, as it turned out. None of that stuff captivated him that much. He wanted to play baseball. And so, you know, he set up his own pitchback and a place to practice throwing strikes. And he had a couple of buddies that were also into baseball. And they just spent a lot of afternoons playing baseball, preparing themselves to be major league ball players. It didn't happen. But they were prepared in case it was going to happen. And they, you know, they know country skills up to a point just because they had to. I mean, I had an outhouse for years. I had propane lights. I'm still off the grid. I have, you know, solar panels and that kind of stuff for whatever electricity I have. But I didn't even have any of that for a long time. It was a really off the grid, kind of a 19th century lifestyle.
So what's your lifestyle like now?
Late 19th century, with computer and TV, you know, satellite dish, satellite computer access, and solar panels and battery bank and an inverter for, you know, whatever amount of electricity. But it's a different lifestyle than what they're living in the city. I'm not really into social media. I'm not, you know, I don't text. I mean, I'm just kind of, I'm not quite a Luddite, but I verge and lean in that direction, let's say. I'm content living an old-fashioned lifestyle. So I guess what I originally envisioned as doing, that's what I ended up doing, which is kind of cool.
What do you think has changed the most?
Well, it's certainly a way more touristy area. When I first got here, the Mendocino Hotel was a funky, run-down hotel. And now it's like this fancy emporium of richness and overblown taste. It's become much more tourist oriented. It was still like, even Mendocino itself was still a town where families actually lived right in town, and people knew each other up and down the coast. Of course, the old timers, oh, when you guys came, you know, it's all different. Before, you'd go up and down the coast and you'd know every car. You'd wave to them and you'd know exactly who was in every car. Probably an exaggeration, but still.
How do you think the Back to the Land movement changed the culture of Mendocino County?
Well, part of it is we're really getting the fruits of it now with the whole cannabis thing. Not all of us, but many of us Back to the Land hippies wanted to grow at least a few plants for our own use of growing some pot. And then, of course, there was the financial aspect. Well, hell, this is a little more than I can use. Maybe I could sell it to my friends in the city and that kind of stuff. But I think a lot of us had a real consciousness of the earth and wanting to be at one with the earth and trying to not harm the land. And I think that that's become part of the ethos of this area, especially along the coast, maybe less so inland in Mendocino. I'm not really sure. I just don't go inland all that much.
Do you feel like you were able to pass those values down to the next generation?
Kids around here are like getting degrees and PhDs, and very few of them want to become high-priced lawyers or high-priced doctors. They, you know, if they go into law, they want to go into public law. They're getting PhDs in environmental engineering and that, you know, those kind of topics. So I think that the kids really have picked up the values of the Back to the Land people way more than they would have in other places. I really think, if anything, the kids come out of the local school systems with a little too much self-confidence, which is exactly the opposite of what was going on when I was a kid. You graduate high school, you be beaten down by that time. But here, people are just hopeful and ready to speak their minds and feel like that their voice is important. kind of like those Parkland kids. You know, I feel like those kids could fit in, or if something like that happened here, that's the kind of reaction there would be here, rather than the let's arm the teacher, you know, that rather than that mentality that's prevalent in a lot of the country. But I don't know if somebody could come up here as like a single father with a kid with one sleeping bag, one broken down car, and two cardboard boxes that held all our belongings and be able to make it. I don't know how it's possible with the rents and the cost of living having gone up so incredibly high over the years. And I'm not sure that even though we have younger people, I'm not sure the community is as welcoming as it was back then. I do worry about that. But I was worried about like no young people taking over the institutions that we created. And they're taking them over now. You know, there's young people running the Great Dane Elk. It took 30 years before they really started engaging them. So hopefully young people are taking over and are going to want to stay, even though they're not going to get rich if they stay here.
So what do you think made it possible for you to come here as a young father with so little and just make it happen?
Probably ignorance helped. I didn't know any better. And yet, you know, but I had a sense that I just had an optimistic sense that this could work, that this was the right place. You know, I got the Elk and it was just, wow, this is so nice. I don't think I'm ever going to leave, and I never have. You know, we were willing to work hard, and we wanted to play hard, and we wanted to make friends and do these country things and enjoy them. And for the most part, those of us that came here and stayed did. You know, we entered stuff in the county fair. We participated in these old-timey activities, some we liked, some we didn't. You know, I never got into being in the rodeo, but I certainly got into entering produce at the fair out of my garden and being proud of it and meeting the old-timers that were entering produce and, you know, getting to know people. It's worked out nicely for those of us that have made it. I think the Back to the Land movement, when it's written, is going to be a very... You know, when the history books are closed on it, it's going to be an interesting sidelight, but I think it is going to have lasting effects. I mean, obviously, the majority of people couldn't live their lives the way that I want to live my life. There just are too many people and not enough land to be able to do it that way. We were very optimistic. Now I'm not so optimistic as I was. But on the other hand, it is true that the younger people, they're still having babies, which takes a pretty high degree of optimism to want to bring children forth into the world as it is today. So at least we've instilled some sort of positive attitude and optimism in these kids.
We've been listening to Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. I'm Sarah Reif. We just heard from George Montag. You can catch short excerpts during the news hour on Thursdays and longer episodes at 3:30 on Thursday afternoons. They're also on our website and Facebook page with pictures and longer versions. Promise of Paradise is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, California Humanities, the Arts Council of Mendocino County, the Judy Pruden Historical Preservation Fund of the Community Foundation of Mendocino County, the Mendocino Institute, and Grace Hudson Museum.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear.